But I want to look at it in terms of this being a good time to take a look at a particular quality of Samuel. We've kind of hinted at it. We've extracted a few things that we've looked at and turned over. But I want to think of him as a leader. I want to talk about spiritual leadership using Samuel as our guide. Now, we all understand that we need leaders in various settings, whatever setting it is. We need someone to step in leadership. We also understand that if a leader is going to be successful, they have to have the support of those people that work alongside them and with them. Also, there's a reminder to pray for those who are in leadership. And so we all have some part to play when we talk about the term leadership. Don't assume first, well, I'm not a leader, so it's just, you know, it's snooze fest time. No, not at all. There's a part for all of us to play. And one of the reasons why I like looking at this from this point of view is because this is a man who did it. I remember I have a number of books on the subject of leadership in my library, and I have two or three by a particular man who I won't name. And he's made his living for a number of years selling books on the subject of leadership. And like I said, I have three or four, and he's published, I don't know, at least a dozen, maybe more, various things on the subject of leadership. Well, I was at a conference a few years ago, and I saw on the conference list that this particular author was going to be one of the speakers. I thought, well, I've read his books. I have his books. This will be fun. And so he did a great presentation on the subject of leadership, and it got me kind of interested. I kind of wondered what his background is. He talked a little bit about it, so it sort of got my curiosity going. So I looked up his bio online and got to checking, and I discovered that the man had never led anything in his entire life, so far as I could find out. He was a college professor, university professor. He had studied leadership. He'd written papers on leadership. He'd taught classes on leadership. But as far as I can tell, to actually lead a group of people other than a classroom, and I guess that's leadership, so I'll give some credit there. But as far as a big organization or a nonprofit organization or a business or that sort of thing, and that doesn't mean he doesn't have something to say on the subject of leadership. I'm not going to pull his books and throw them away. But there's something to be said about somebody who is a leader that you see it lived out in real life, in the real ebb and flow of life. And I think you see really on display, and really this is the next to the last episode in Samuel's ministry. Basically, he had this confrontation with Saul. It's the last time he sees Saul this side of the grave. And then in chapter 16, he goes and is sent by God to anoint the next king of Israel, which is David. And that's basically the end of his story. And then, of course, as I've already alluded to, there's one little bit of Samuel speaking from beyond the grave. And we will make sure we cover that as we study his life together. So thank you for your patience, and thank you for your participation as we have been studying this. I think this is our 15th portion of our study through the life of Samuel, and thank you for sticking with it. So, spiritual leadership. I want to just pick it up, if you will, in verse 12 of this chapter. And you remember that where we left off was basically verse 11, where it says that it grieved Samuel, and he cried out to the Lord all night. And remember, God was grieved, and Samuel was grieved. And then it says in verse 12, "So when Samuel rose early in the morning to meet Saul, it was told Samuel, saying, 'Saul went to Carmel, and indeed he set up a monument for himself, and he has gone on around, passed by, and gone down to Gilgal.'" In other words, if you're going to find King Saul, you're going to have to kind of chase him down, and here's the route. There's something very telling. Did you notice it in verse 12? Now, maybe I should just take a moment to review. You remember very early in chapter 15, God told, through Samuel, told Saul that he wanted to have this group of people known as the Amalekites just completely done away with. Nothing was to be left. And I know that sounds maybe harsh, but we dealt with that last time. And you remember that Saul, instead of destroying everything, keeps the best of the loot, so to speak, and he also keeps the king alive. And then you come to verse 11. While Saul is going out Samuel is going out to meet Saul. I wish these guys had different names and they both didn't start with S, because I have to slow down and make sure I'm saying the right name. But Samuel is chasing Saul down, and it says in verse 12, he set up a monument for himself. Doesn't that just give you a little hint about what everything that's wrong with King Saul at this point. He's building a big monument for himself. He's trying to look good. And part of bringing all this stuff home, all the sheep and all the animals and all the good stuff, and keeping his living trophy, this king of the Amalekites, alive, was partly to make him look good. Verse 13. Then Samuel went to Saul, and Saul said to him, quote, "Blessed are you of the Lord. I have performed the commandment of the Lord." I kind of think he said it in a big bolster sound. He wanted everybody to hear. "Look at what I've done. Look what I've done for you." Well, if you've been with us through the story up to this point, you know that he was not blessing the Lord by his obedience, and he certainly had not performed all that God had wanted him to do. Verse 14, Samuel calls him out with one statement, with one question, really. But Samuel said, verse 14, "What then is the bleating of the sheep in my ears and lowing of the oxen which I hear?" Busted. Can we say it that way? So I want to share with you four things that leaders do, spiritual leaders do. And I want us just to kind of think through them and kind of put this into our life and our world, and whether it's in our prayer life or into our active life as leaders in the Lord, for the Lord. First of all, leaders need to avoid distraction. Leaders need to avoid distraction. I kind of think that verse 13, when Samuel is told by Saul, "Blessed are you of the Lord," I think that probably was an attempt at flattery, don't you? Saul, the king Saul is so glad to see this prophet coming that he's just going to say, "You're the biggest blessing. Sam, you're the biggest blessing I could ever experience. God has blessed me that you've come into my presence." A lesser man than this man might have cracked and bent at that point. "Oh, well, what have you come, Samuel?" "Oh, never mind. It's not that big a deal anyway." Well, we know why he'd come, because this sin needed to be dealt with. So he avoids distraction. Immediately he turns around in the next verse and says, "What do I hear? I hear sheep. I hear the oxen. I hear what I hear. And those are not the sounds that are to be heard. God told you that all that had to be destroyed." There's all sorts of distractions that we have in our world today. And leaders face this all the time. And it's just a reminder to all of us to pray for our leaders and to pray for each other and also for ourselves, that we just need to stay on target and not be distracted. Don't be distracted by what you may not want to do. Sometimes that's what distracts us. "Well, I don't really want to do that, so let me just distract myself. Let's just go do something else." If you've read to the end of this chapter, you know that it has an ending, how should we say, that probably doesn't show up in the little bedtime Bible story books that you read your kids at the beginning of their life, okay? It's not exactly pleasant. I'll give you a little spoiler there, but he has to do some very serious activity for the cause of God. It probably wasn't something he was really excited about doing. I mean, most of us are not excited about going to the king and basically pointing finger in his face and saying, "You have messed up and God is going to punish you and God is going to deal with you." But he didn't distract it by what may not have been popular in his own mind. But also, don't be distracted in what others want you to do. I kind of take it that when Samuel shows up, Saul's just wanting, okay, here's that prophet. Every time he shows up, something goes haywire. Every time he shows up, I feel bad. Every time he shows up, he says something's wrong. So I'll just go out and just pour honey all over him. Blessed are you. It's a blessing that God has sent you. Be very careful that we don't get distracted about what God wants us to do. And it's very easy for us in a world where our own push and pull of our own hearts push us away if we're not careful and not walking with the Lord. But also we have a world that seeks to push us in certain ways. You know, we live in a world today that worships a new idol. It's not necessarily a brand new idol, but it's an idol that has risen to the top rung of the ladder in our culture today. And the idol is the idol of tolerance. Now, there's nothing wrong with tolerance and understand there's difference of opinion, but there are some things that are just right and just wrong because God said they're right and wrong. And it doesn't mean we don't love sinners, but we're not going to tolerate sin or call it something other than what it is. But we live in a world where that we worship, our society worships us at the idol of tolerance. And they tell us all the time in no uncertain terms, you just need to be quiet. You shouldn't preach against this, shouldn't preach against that, and so forth. But we need to stay on message. We need to stay on target. We're also told in this, because of this idol of tolerance, we're also told to preach a gospel that is exclusive. In other words, that we believe, as Jesus said, He said, I am the way, the truth, and life. No one comes to the Father but by me. We live in a world where we don't want to hear that. We don't want that broadcast. We want tolerance to say, as long as you're sincere, it doesn't matter what religion you are, what your worship is like. All that matters is you're sincere. That's what we're told. You've heard that. So we need to just make sure that we avoid the distraction internally and externally. What did Samuel do? He says, what is then, verse 14, what is this bleating of the sheep in my ears and the lowing of the ox in my ear? And then Saul comes back with his answer. And Saul said, is that the right word? Think with me here through this statement. They have brought them from the Amalekites, for the people spared the best of the sheep and the oxen to sacrifice to the Lord your God, and the rest we've utterly destroyed. He contradicts him with himself with his own words. You cannot utterly destroy something and still have some of it left. I mean, even his own language is inconsistent. But notice who he's blaming. Oh, all those people, they did that. And the people spared them. There's no personal responsibility. There's nothing that he takes upon himself. And then he puts one more in there. That just to kind of twist it. And we've done this for God. We've done this for God. We're going to sacrifice all this to the Lord. I don't mean to be skeptical, but I really doubt if that was the intention. I kind of think he thought of it right then on the spot. Oh, let's throw a little bit of more ammo into the conversation. Oh, and by the way, we're going to sacrifice all these animals to the Lord. It's going to be a worship service like you have never seen before. We say the best. This is a God thing. Verse 16. This is a little stern. Remember now, he's talking to the king. The king was the king. You know, we live in a world where we're used to criticizing and with our speech that we have as part of our constitutional rights, we can say whatever we want to say, and we can criticize and we can complain. You just didn't do that with a king. It's a whole different ballgame. Verse 16. Then Samuel said to Saul, "Be quiet, and I will tell you what the Lord said to me last night." Second thing that this spiritual leader does, and all spiritual leaders should do, is leaders announce God's message. He's not distracted by the excuses of Saul. He's not distracted by trying to twist it into something it's not that Saul tries to do. He's not distracted by the flattery of Saul. He's not distracted by what's going on. He just simply says, I have a message. Let me tell you what God told me last night, and I'm going to tell you. He looks at the king, and he just basically tells him to shut up. Just be quiet. Enough talk. I'm going to do the talking. Where does that kind of boldness come from? Well, it's right there in the text. I will tell you what the Lord said to me last night. And if we're going to have boldness as leaders and boldness as we try to influence our culture and our community, we just need to understand that we say what God says. That's where our authority rests. If God has said it, what else do you need? What else do you need? If we really believe it is God's word. Because God, as we know, trumps everything. God, as we know, is above everyone. God, as we know, is beyond all. So he just simply says what God says. So that reminds us, leaders announce God's message and make sure that what we say is not less than God says. Make sure we don't leave anything out. And that's what he's about to do in these next verses. Now, Saul, and it's not our intention to spend too much time on Saul, but you have to kind of understand it because it interrelates in the activity. But he says to him in the end, and he said to him, verse 16, and he said to him, speak on. So Samuel said, and he begins to kind of tell the story up to that point. But one of the things you see about Saul, he never completely ever confesses sin. In fact, if it looks like, as you go through this story here in just a moment, it looks like he's repenting. But it's never really genuine. It's never really real. It's always somebody else's fault. No, we wanted to do that. In just a moment, he's going to talk about obedience. I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit, but it just doesn't square. But he just makes sure that he says nothing less than what God says. Here's what he says, verse 17. So Samuel said, "When you were little in your own eyes, were you not the head of the tribes of Israel? And did not the Lord anoint you king over Israel?" Notice where he begins with this little message. You are who you are by the benevolence, the grace, the appointment of God himself. It points him back to the responsibility that he had. And he says, verse 18, "Now the Lord sent you on a mission." God put you where you should be, and then God has told you what you should do, and here he repeats it. Verse 18, "Go and utterly destroy the sinners, the Amalekites, and fight against them until they are consumed." God put you where you are. God told you what to do. And then he asks the question, "Why then did you not obey the voice of the Lord? Why did you swoop down on the spoil and do evil in the sight of the Lord?" And then he stops. You know, this really isn't in the text, but I just kind of thought about this way, and you see if this works for you. Yeah, we make sure we say no, not less than God says, but we need to make sure that we don't say more than God says, not more than God says. He kind of spells it all out, and then he stops. Don't you imagine if he were a lesser man, Samuel would have just gotten Saul's face and says, "And let me just give you a full piece of my mind. You know what you've done to me? You've made me look bad. I'm the guy who poured oil on your head and you went out and messed up. I'm the prophet and I'm supposed to be the guy that's the spiritual leader in your life and you've made me look bad." And there's none of that. Samuel makes this not at all personal about himself. This is all about where you stand before God. I love the fact that he just speaks God's message and then he stops. We can get in trouble with either one of those two things you see on the screen. If we fail to fully state God's message, or if we think we have more of a message, if we think God needs some help adding to it, that can get us in trouble as well. And usually when that happens, we've attached it to ourselves personally. We're offended. We're hurt. We want to get things right. We want revenge. We want, you know, envy and discontentment, all those things kind of filter in, and we just want to let someone have it just because they deserve it. When God just wants us to speak his truth and leave it there. And that's exactly what this man does. And that should be true whether it's someone in the pulpit. And you pray for me, you pray for others that teach, and whether it's in their small groups or in other venues, that God would just keep us in that within those parameters, between those white lines along the road. Make sure you don't say less than God says. Make sure you don't say more than God says. In fact, you go over to the last chapter of the Bible, in Revelation 22, you remember how it kind of all ends? John basically says, speaking on behalf of God, he says, "Don't add to and don't take away from this word, or God will take away and add to you these punishments, these tribulations, these harsh things that are happening." So we don't mess with it. And then we have the core of this whole encounter in verses 20 and following as we go down through it. But one more thing about 19. This also is indicative of what was wrong with Saul's heart. "Why did you swoop down on the spoil and do evil in the sight of the Lord?" Basically, he calls him out and says, it wasn't because you wanted to sacrifice. It wasn't because you wanted to do something good for God. It wasn't because all the people made you. You took what you wanted. You swooped. And the pictures of a bird of prey swooping down on its victim and just grabbing it and carrying it off. He said, you just saw it and you lusted after it. You were so filled with this desire to have, and you grabbed it and you ran with it, in other words. Now verse 20. Poor Saul is still not getting it. And Saul said to Samuel, "But I have obeyed the voice of the Lord and gone on the mission which the Lord sent me, and brought back Agag, king of Amalek, and I have utterly destroyed the Amalekites." Have you ever noticed when someone starts lying, it just gets worse the more you lie? And some of us know that. The great thing is this. If you always tell the truth, you don't need a good memory. If you just tell the truth, you don't need a good memory. If you're going to be telling falsehoods, you better have a really good memory, because you got to remember what it was said and how it was. I don't even know what to do with verse 20. Because notice what he says. "I have brought back Agag, king of Amalek." That means he's what by his ethnicity? He's an Amalekite. And the next phrase he says, "I have utterly destroyed the Amalekites." And exhibit A is standing right there. I mean, he's grasping after straws, And it's just a reminder. It's not our point to talk too much about Saul, but it's a reminder, and I can't resist, that God just wants us to just own up to our flaws and our responsibilities and confess our sin. There's no talking our way out of it. There's no explaining it. There's no justifying it. He adds to it in 21. "But the people took the plunder, sheep and oxen, the best of the things, which should have been utterly destroyed, to sacrifice to the Lord your God in Gilgal." Don't you understand? They had the best of intentions. The best of intentions will always fail in light of what God has declared to be right, and the question remains about whether we are obedient to that or not. Now, if you have, depending on how your Bible is set up, and there's some that are one column and two columns, I understand that. But in most translations, verses 22 and 23 are shifted into a poetic form. Because this is what, you don't see it in the Bible particularly often, but it's really an oracle. It's sort of going beyond just what he has to say to Saul, and he kind of makes this timeless statement on behalf of God. It's a way of sort of elevating it to a higher understanding. And here's what he said, 22. "Then Samuel said, 'Has the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed than the fat of rams. For rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft, and stubbornness is as the iniquity and stubbornness is as iniquity and idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he has also rejected you from being king." Period. These were not the words that Saul wanted to hear. And even as I read them, do they not just kind of, I mean, there's some weight there. I mean, basically, you as a king have had it. God has reached his limit with you. And it's interesting, as he states this statement, and I just want to just kind of bring this up on the screen so we get it on the screen. The third thing leaders do is they affirm a heart of obedience. The heart of obedience. Basically, and we'll see this just a little bit later as we kind of go through these last few verses in just a few moments, that God has been patient with Saul up to this point, and at this point it's over. There's nothing that Saul can do to recover. Nothing he can do. But then you think a little bit later, in chapter 16, Samuel is going to be sent out to find the next king, and of course we know it to be David, and he's anointed, and you know a little bit about that story. But David is not a perfect king either. I mean, we might think, well, yeah, he didn't kill all the Amalekites, and he didn't destroy all of their herds and flocks. But David, on the other hand, was an adulterer and a murderer. David was not removed from being king. David's line that went through his heirs was not cut off, as was Saul's. In fact, you know from the messianic understanding that it's through the line of David that the Messiah is going to come. What is the difference? It's really found in these words. And it comes down to a heart. Saul had a heart of rebellion. David, in spite of his sinfulness, in spite of his flaw, had a heart that would at least respond to the rebuke. And when sin was brought to his attention, he repented sincerely and threw himself on the mercy of God. Saul never did. It comes down to the heart, a heart of obedience. First of all, obedience is what most honors God. That's what he says. He says, has the Lord a great delight in burnt offerings, verse 22, and sacrifices, as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice. Sacrifice was part of their worship, and sometimes we have trouble relating to it. But just think of it as the activity that you did in worship. We could substitute our own list of things that we do in worship. And if you just substitute our own list, it becomes very clear. Does God want us to have a heart that loves people? Or does he want us to make sure we fill a church pew on Sunday? You understand, heart trumps activity. God wants us to give of our resources to support the ministry. But is God as pleased with us dropping something in the offering plate as he is with us being honest in our dealings and our everyday life? You suddenly understand it. The heart is so much more important than it's not that the activities are unimportant either, but it has to have the right heart with it. And then he makes this statement in 23, which is interesting. For rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft, and stubbornness is as iniquity and idolatry. How is rebellion like witchcraft, and how is stubbornness like idolatry? If you think this through, it kind of makes some sense. If I rebel, in other words, God's told me to do this, but I choose to do that, in this case, destroy the Amalekites, I'm going to keep the king and the animals for myself and build a monument for myself. Okay, that's what Saul had done. The fact that you choose a path that is opposed to God's path of obedience, in essence says, I know that this, for whatever, however we process this, I think it's a better outcome to go this direction of disobedience than to follow obedience. Somehow this has an advantage. Somehow this is going to work out in the future to my advantage. And that's the whisper that Satan tells us, and that's what our own sinful flesh tells us. And we make that calculation. It's better to sin. That has a better outcome than to follow God. Witchcraft was all about trying to tell the future. Divination might be as good a word to put in there as even witchcraft. But he's basically saying, if you think you can disobey God and it's going to be a better outcome than what God says, you're predicting the future. You're as bad as the fortune tellers and the seance conductors and all the occult practitioners, because you think you know the future better than God himself. Do you ever think about that? Willful sin is like witchcraft and all that stuff. That's what he says right there in the text. And then he says stubbornness is as idolatry. Stubbornness is idolatry. This one might have to think through a little bit, but as we think about it, there's a similarity to it. It's a form of idolatry because an insubordinate person, a person who's rebellious, puts himself in the place of God. God says, this is right or wrong, and we say, no, I'm going to do it the opposite way. We have put ourselves in the place of the moral judge, and we can dictate for ourselves what is right and wrong. So when we willfully disobey, not only are we kind of trying to make the future outcome different than what God dictates it to be, but we are putting ourselves in a place that only God deserves, and that is idolatry. That's the reason he uses that terminology. So, obedience most honors God, and then the last thing we want to understand about in this section is disobedience won't be overlooked either. And that's verse 24 and following. Then Saul said to Samuel, now this sounds good. I have sinned, for I have transgressed the commandment of the Lord and your words, because I feared the people and obeyed their voice. He still can't quite get a real confession out, can he? Right? Just say, I sinned, and I sinned because I listened to them, you know, and that's kind of the whole deal. Verse 25, now therefore, please pardon my sin and return with me that I may worship the Lord. It's so close. But part of the contrast you're going to see in chapter 16, where God is looking on the heart, Saul is all external. But Samuel said to Saul, I will not return with you, for you have rejected the word of the Lord, and the Lord has rejected you from being king over Israel. And as Samuel turned to go away, Saul seized the edge of his robe, and it tore. Now, I got to tell you, I've always thought that he's just desperate to grab Samuel. Don't leave me. You know, he just kind of lunges after and grabs him. But when it says he grabs his part of his robe, when it says there that he seized the edge of his robe, one of the things I've learned recently is if you wanted to really beseech somebody, especially a person in authority, if you went before a king or a judge or something and you were throwing yourself on your mercy, you would get down and you would grab the fringe of their garment. Because the fringe of the garment in their day said something about your status, your position, your social standing. For those of you that have been in the military, you will understand what I'm about to say. When you see someone in a uniform, you stop and see how many stripes they happen to have on their uniform. And if they have more stripes on their uniform than you have, you better salute them, correct? That's the way that works. The fringe of the garment was like the stripes on the uniform. So you would say, I'm going to bow down and I'm going to grab this fringe of the garment, saying, I'm appealing to you. But then in this process, it rips and it tears. You don't pull the stripes off the general, okay? You don't pull the fringe off of someone's garment. But Samuel takes that as you're still trying to, you've pulled out something, you've pulled something away to yourself, you've grasped something that doesn't belong to you. It says in 28, so Samuel said to him, the Lord has torn the kingdom of Israel from you today and has given it to a neighbor of yours who is better than you. He uses this tearing, and even though it would have been a normal means of supplication, the fact that it's torn, it says, God is just as my symbol of who I am was torn, God has torn you away. No longer, you've so messed up. 29, and also the strength of Israel will not lie nor relent, for he is not a man that he should relent. Notice how God, that's by the way an interesting title of God you see there in 29, the strength of Israel. That's a title of God. He will not lie nor relent, for he is not a man that he should relent. Well, I thought God was patient. I thought God was forgiving. That is true. But you also remember, there is a point where God's patience is exhausted. There is a point where judgment will fall. God is not willing that any should perish, but all should come to repentance. But the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, as it says in 2 Peter 3. And he has reached that point. I don't know about you, but it's sort of that sort of puts a chill up your spine, that he's reached the point that there's no more remedy. There's nothing else that can be done. Then he said, I have sinned, yet... Poor Saul. Then he said, I have sinned, yet honor me now, please, before the elders of my people and before Israel. Return with me that I may worship the Lord your God. Will you at least go back and stand with me while I go through the outward ritual of worshiping God so it looks good before all these people that are looking at me? He's very externally focused. So disobedience will not be overlooked. So Samuel turned back after Saul, and Saul worshiped the Lord, okay? So they went through that ritual. But then these last few verses, number 4, leaders address the real issues. The real issues, not the make-believe issues, not the spin, not the things that we don't want people to see, but the real issues. And by the way, this is the part you're not going to see in the children's book, okay? Then Samuel said, bring Agag, king of the Amalekites, here to me. So Agag came to him cautiously, and Agag said, surely the bitterness of death is past. Boy, I've just kind of skated through this one. Somehow I've navigated through the danger. But Samuel said, as your sword has made women childless, so shall your mother be called childless among women. And Samuel hacked Agag in pieces before the Lord in Gilgal. I can't add much to that. I don't think I want to add much to that. But the real issue was to obey God, and no one else would do it. The leader steps into place. We'll just add this to the list. Leaders finish what others do not. This was Saul's responsibility. It didn't get done. Samuel finishes the job, as distasteful as it was. and he makes sure that God is honored. Then Samuel went up to Ramah, and Saul went up to his house at Gibeah of Saul. And Samuel went no more to see Saul until the day of his death. That would be Samuel's death, because he preceded Saul. Nevertheless, Samuel mourned for Saul, and the Lord regretted that he had made Saul king over Israel. This was the last time that Samuel was in the presence of King Saul. It wasn't like, well, you know, a week later, that's probably long enough. I'll go back and we'll be buddies again. Or, you know what, I hadn't enough time passed that we've forgotten about all those things years ago. He didn't back down. And that's the last thing I'll say. Don't back down. Leaders can't back down with what they need to do. And sometimes that's difficult. I understand that. Sometimes there's pressure. But leaders address the real issue. And we have finished the story of Samuel and Saul. We haven't quite finished, let me restate that. This side of the grave, we have finished the story of Samuel and Saul. Chapter 16 is a whole lot more fun. He's going out to anoint the new king, and we'll look at that next time.